We're turning this evening then to chapter 6 in the book of Revelation. And I'll read verse 1. Revelation chapter 6 and verse 1. And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, probably to arrest his attention and to communicate something of the authority of what was about to be divulged. One of the four beasts saying, "Come and see." This chapter, in some ways, reveals the world as it really is. The world that we must expect to live in. Not simply because we are Christians, because God reveals here the world that he has permitted, appointed to be. Revelation chapter 5 and verse 1 introduced us to this book or scroll. And we noted that it was written within and on the backside. In other words, there were no empty spaces. The book of God's sovereign will and purpose is complete. Nothing happens by chance. God superintends everything. And it is sealed with seven seals. And we know that seven is the number of completeness. 7 days in a week. Seven churches making up a representation of the whole church. And so this scroll or book sealed with seven seals, it is the complete, the whole plan of God. And in this chapter, six of the seals will be broken. It will reveal God's purposes, and it will convey to us the fact that the Lamb, he who has died for us, to whom we belong, is superintending all that is revealed. He's described or declared to be the executor of God's purposes. And he is praised in the previous chapter as worthy to rule and to reign. These seals represent one scene. And they take us from the time of John right through to the end time. The end where the day of judgment is described at the end of this chapter. And the seals often reveal bad things, as we shall see. Yet all are under the superintendence of God and Christ. Now you remember this early church was made up of many who were living in poverty and hardship, slaves in the Roman Empire, many who were subject to martyrdom and persecution. There were many, what you would say would be gloomy and bad experiences, which the early believers had to face. This chapter is a tremendous reassurance to them, but also to us. I remember speaking to Pastor Jacob about this chapter, and he said, "This is just what the people of Sri Lanka need to hear." He said, "It hadn't dawned on me until recently how appropriate it was for those needy believers struggling with poverty and the hostility of their communities. This chapter especially is so reassuring to such people." So let's go through these seals one by one. Firstly, the first seal is opened, and John sees, verse 2, "Behold, look, a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer." The world in which we may expect to live is a world in which Christ is conquering the hearts of his people. The white horse here is referred to later in chapter 19. And if we compare these two verses, we can understand who is depicted. So chapter 19, verse 11, I saw heaven opened, and behold a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war. His eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. He was clothed with a vesture, dipped in blood. His name is called the Word of God. And then later, verse 16, on his vesture and on his thigh, a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. There can be no doubt that the first seal introduces John to an all-conquering Christ. He's upon a white horse, symbolizing purity and heavenly nature. It is a symbol, but it speaks of Christ's work. We can go back to Psalm 45. Some of you will remember this psalm, but perhaps you could also almost say that Revelation helps us to be sure who Psalm 45 is about. Verse 3, gird thy sword upon thy thigh, O most mighty, with thy glory and thy majesty, and in thy majesty ride prosperously, because of truth and meekness and righteousness, and thy right hand shall teach thee terrible things. Thine arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies, whereby the people fall under thee. Thy throne, O God, is for ever and ever. A sceptre of thy kingdom is a right sceptre. Hebrews 1 quotes verse 6, referring to Christ. So we know that the picture here is also of Christ. Just look at verse 5 before we move. Thine arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies. The arrows of conviction. Have you felt them? Have I felt them? Has God pursued us when we were determined to live the way of the world, to walk in sinful pleasures? And yet the Lord sent one of the arrows of conviction with the power of his word, and it arrested us. It caused us to fall under him, to humble ourselves before him and seek his mercy and pardon. That's how Christ conquers his people. He brings them to gladly, to willingly yield to his ways. Thy people shall be willing in the day of thy power. It is a work of conviction, of conversion, and also of sanctification. We are not fully conquered. Sin still reigns in our hearts, works in our hearts. The reign is broken. The dominion is broken if we are true Christians, but there's still the ongoing work of Christ within by his Spirit, bringing us fully and finally to be completely delivered from sin when we come to eternity itself. So this is the first of the seals, and John sees Christ going forth, conquering and to conquer. He has a crown given unto him. That reminds us that he is to be received as a king, says Matthew Henry. It also reminds us and almost intimates here that he is crowned before he has completed his triumphs. So certain is his conquest that he can be crowned the victor as he rides forth. None will resist his irresistible grace. Then secondly, a second seal is broken in verse 3, And John sees another horse that was red. Red is the colour of blood. It's the colour of fire. And him that sat upon this particular horse was ordained to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. Now, there are those that focus upon this red horse and say, this is the horse that represents warfare. And there will be wars that will lead to much bloodshed. But it's unlikely that this horse refers or represents warfare. Most of the better commentators say this is the horse or the red horse of persecution. The great sword referred to here at the end of verse 4 is actually a great short sword. It was the sword that was used as the sacrificial knife, referred to in that sense. In Matthew 10 verse 34, when the Lord says, I came not to bring peace, but a sword. It's this word that is used. And then he speaks of family members rising up against each other because of their faith. So this is the sword of persecution. They shall kill one another, we read in verse 4. And the word used to refer to kill here, it's used by the Apostle John almost exclusively for persecution killings. It was used in 1 John 3 verse 12, Cain killed Abel. Why did Cain kill Abel? Abel is the first martyr. It was because of his faith. It was because his offering was accepted by God and Cain's wasn't. In chapter 5 and verse 6, John sees a lamb slain, as it had been slain. That's the same word. And so the picture here is of persecution. What kind of world must we expect? The scriptures give this reassurance. A world in which the gospel, under the power of Christ, will achieve many conquests. But a world of persecution. And the red horse of persecution swiftly follows the white horse of gospel conquest. And wherever the white horse of Christ's gospel conquest are most active, there we may expect there will be most persecution. I told you last week, I think, that I'd read the life of George Whitefield on our holiday, and it was a reminder to me just how much Whitefield suffered hostility for his preaching. He was warned that if he went to speak to a certain group, they would almost certainly kill him. He had stones thrown at him. He was ridiculed by the London Theatre. A play was made caricaturing him in the most cruel terms. Why? Because Whitefield was a great instrument used by the Lord. Many thousands heard him preach. He was maligned, misrepresented, falsely accused, threatened. Wherever the gospel is, the red horse will follow. Then we see the third seal is broken. Verse 5. When he had opened the third seal. Remember, it's the Lord. It's the Lamb who opens these seals. John, you need to understand that though there will be persecution, God has ordained it. It's within the book of his decrees. It is subject to Christ's superintendence. The Lamb opens the seal that reveals persecution. Satan may hound, but Christ has chained him. He will only be permitted thus far and no further. We come to this third seal, and John sees a black horse. And he that sat on the black horse has a pair of balances or scales in his hand. And this next verse, it may seem mysterious, but it's not really. I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, a measure of wheat for a penny, three measures of barley for a penny. See thou hurt not the oil and the wine. A penny here represented a day's pay. A measure of wheat was sufficient to feed the man himself, but not his family. And so the first two phrases here describe poverty, hardship, economic stringency. A measure of wheat for a penny. That's all a man earns. He can feed himself, nothing more. If he has family, he's got to buy the less decent flour, the measures of barley. He can get three measures for his penny. See thou touch not the oil and the wine. Luxury goods will be afforded by the rich, but the staple diet of the poor will be hard to come by. Inequality, injustice, poverty. That's the world that is revealed to John. Many of the early believers, they were on the poor end of the spectrum of society. They knew what it was to scrape and scrimp. But John is to reassure them, this is the world that God has ordained. He's permitted these things. Take heart. Be of good cheer. Christ has overcome the world. Remember, Christ said himself, the poor you will always have with you. There will always be inequality. God has ordained that these things shall take place. He's not the author of misery, but the misery that is being revealed here is subject to his superintendence. It was given to the red horse, or him that sat upon the red horse, to take peace from the earth. If we turn to Revelation chapter 13, verse 7, there's a parallel verse, really, that perhaps is worth noting here. Verse 17 says that no man might buy or sell save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. I don't want to be sidetracked this evening. What is the beast exactly? Whether it's Satan, whether it's a satanic influence in this world, but really what is being set forth here is the fact that there will be times in the world where only those who follow the world and who are subject to Satan's sway will be able to prosper. If you're a Christian and you stand for Christian principles, there will be times when you won't be able to get the best jobs because you will stand for those things that you believe to be true. You won't be prepared to lie or cheat. You won't be prepared to compromise your principles. You love the Lord. You will stand and represent Christ. And many will say, we don't want such a person in our office or in our shop or on our factory floor and so on. That's what's being forewarned here. We come to the fourth beast. The fourth seal. Verse 7. When he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, come and see. And I looked, and behold a pale horse. Some say this could be translated a greenish coloured horse, gaunt, somewhat fearful, dreadful, and his name that sat on him was Death, and Hell followed with him, and power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth. We should remember this is symbolic, not a quarter, strictly speaking, but a proportion. To kill with the sword, that's the war sword. The world in which John is being glimpsed is a world where there will be warfare, and war will kill with hunger or famine. Famine will kill with death, literally pestilence. There will be pandemics, there will be plagues, and with beasts of the earth, sudden, unexpected calamities, catastrophes. Someone bitten by a snake, attacked by a lion. And in our modern world, the picture here still stands, car accidents, plane crashes, accidents at work, in the home. These things will take place. It's glimpsed here by this pale horse. Death will take people early and unexpectedly. John, this is the world that you and your fellow believers will be living in. But be encouraged. Power, verse 8, power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth. God has ordained. He's permitted. He's superintending even war and famine and pestilences. They will come. Should we begin to think, what on earth is happening? Is God really in control? Is Christ really supreme over all events? This chapter says yes. Christ opens the seal. God, in his sovereign will, has permitted all these woes, all these calamities, but ultimately Christ is going forth conquering and to conquer. The fifth seal is opened, verse 9. And John sees under the altar, close to the Lord, the souls of them that were slain for the word of God, the martyrs. They are nearest to the Lord. They cried with a loud voice, saying, Holy, how long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood? This is not a cry of vindictiveness and revenge. It is a cry of holy jealousy. These are the martyrs that bore witness to God and to Christ and the truth. They faithfully warned. They faithfully stood firm for the true God. And yet it would seem that their testimony has been trampled underfoot. And it is in holy jealousy that God would arise, that his enemies should be scattered, that they make this cry. It's not a cry of revenge in that sense. So the commentators believe. Look at verse 11. Here is the consolation. White robes, symbols of purity, of festivity, of honour, were given unto every one of them. And it was said unto them that they should rest yet a little while, a little season, until their fellow servants also should be killed. So here are five characteristics of the world in which we live. A world in which the gospel is advancing. A world of persecution. A world of inequality, a world of calamity, and unexpected death. A world in which the saints are subject to patience. A world of divine forbearance. God will allow the wicked to march on in their way, despite the cry of the martyrs, for a time. It's only for a season. And thus we come to the sixth seal, verse 12. I beheld, when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake. Now, when we read the verses that follow, remember Revelation as a symbolic book. Will there be an earthquake, a great earthquake, on that last great day? Possibly. But we needn't point to this verse and say, it definitely means there will be an earthquake. The whole picture here symbolically speaks of terror that will affect and overwhelm the whole community of the human race. It will be a time of awful upheaval, an earthquake, the sun becoming black, the moon becoming blood, the stars of heaven falling to the earth. That suggests symbolism, because the stars often are much vaster than the earth itself. But the picture is one of terrible judgment. The heaven departing as a scroll rolled together. Every mountain and island moved out of their places as if they would no longer be seen. And then this universal cry of woe, affecting every part, every strata in society, from the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich, the chief captains of industry, of education, of the media world, the mighty men, the army generals, and even the bondmen, the slaves, the ordinary free laymen. All of them cry to the mountains and rocks to cover them from the wrath of the Lamb. John sees that the world in which we live is a world that is awaiting that final solemn hour when the Lord will bring final judgment. But I don't want to stop there. We have just a few minutes left. Look at the beginning of chapter 7. Because the seventh seal will not be opened until the beginning of chapter 8. And the seventh seal really will open the door to a new scene, a new depiction of the whole of the last days, the gospel era. But before the judgment finally falls upon the earth and the wrath of the Lamb is exercised, John sees an interlude. Verse 1 in chapter 7. After these things I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth. These are the winds of destruction, the winds that will bring that final act of the wrath of the Lamb upon the whole human race. But before that happens, and this is a vision, remember, it's symbolic, nothing can take place until the servants of Christ or the servants of God have been sealed. Verse 3, hurt not the earth, the sea, the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. The seal in the ancient world had a threefold purpose. It symbolized or signified protection. Remember, Pilate sealed the tombstone of Christ's sepulchre. Because that seal was upon that stone, it was the Roman seal, it basically said, don't mess with this grave. Don't tamper. It was a seal of protection. And the servants of God are going to be sealed as if to say, don't touch them. When the four winds held by the angels that would execute the wrath of the Lamb, the seal, those that are sealed are protected. But the seal also is a seal of ownership. In Song of Solomon 8, verse 6, set me as a seal upon thine heart. In Ephesians 1, it speaks of being sealed by the Spirit of God. It was a seal of ownership. These are the servants of God, of Christ. They belong to him. And lastly, it is a seal of authentication, a certification. These are genuine. They are the Lord's true people. How many were sealed? 144,000. Well, I'd love to go into the significance of that number, but time is out. Just move to the end of chapter 7 and we will look at this another week. Those that are sealed, John sees them and he is asked at the end of this chapter, who are they? These are they that came out of great tribulation. They had to experience all of the previous five seals, the persecution, the poverty, the calamities of the earth. They knew those sorrows, but they were brought out of great tribulation. They have washed their robes, made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore are they before the throne of God, and serve him day and night in his temple. And he that sitteth on the throne shall dwell among them. Who is he that sits upon the throne? John saw him at the beginning of this scene. Now he is referred to at the end of the scene as having the elect and the saints of God around him. They shall hunger no more, thirst no more. The sun shall not light on them, nor any heat. For the Lamb in the midst of the throne shall feed them, and shall lead them unto living fountains of waters, and God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. You looked at this recently, but you see the picture. The sixth seal brings John face to face with the awful, terrible judgment that all who are outside of Christ shall face. They will be filled with horror and with anguish at the great day of the wrath of the Lamb. But those who are sealed, they are Christ's. They will be brought through. And ultimately, the Lamb will feed them and lead them. There could be no greater contrast, could there, between the solemn day of judgment for those who are outside of Christ and those whom Christ will come to redeem and receive unto himself. Let me ask this question as we close. Where will you be? If that solemn hour should come tonight and Christ should descend like a flash of lightning, where would you be? Would you be amongst the saints of God, sealed, and therefore under divine protection, ready to welcome the Lamb? If you are, because you have believed in him and cast yourself upon him, you need not fear that last great day. But if as yet you have held out against Christ and never called upon him for mercy, then the prospect of his return is as the wrath of the Lamb. Solemn contrast. Well, may the Lord bless these things to us this evening. We close our worship with hymn 305. Lo, he comes with clouds descending, once for favoured sinners slain. 305.